Thank you. Well, thank you very much for the introduction. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I've been only once to Denmark before, about 15 years ago, as a tourist. So now I'm turning back as a missionary of Austrian economics. I didn't anticipate at the time. At the time, I think I didn't even know what Austrian economics was. But so here we are, 15 years later. A lot of water has flown down the Rhine and the Öresund. As I always say to my students in Angers, that the reason why I constantly stop my lectures about 10 or 15 minutes before I'm supposed to is because that, as a professor with a fixed salary, it's the only way to increase your real wage rate. Okay. Now here, they're cutting the lunch breaks, and I guess instead of salmon and mussels and so on, we'll get a smørrebrød. Now that's a kind of a decrease of a non-monetary wage rate, right? So I've learned something from my Danish friends again. Our subject this morning is Mises and the Austrian School. And so it was a wise decision to cut down the lunch breaks rather than have me drop every eighth word, because then the sentences wouldn't make much sense. So Mises, I guess, you know, certain things about him, otherwise he wouldn't have shown up here. Mises is, in a word, is the most important economist of the 20th century, and he happens to be a member of the Austrian school. As far as I'm concerned, that probably holds true for Hans Hermann Hoppe and many others too. One reason, or probably the most essential reason why I would call myself an Austrian economist, is because I'm convinced that Mises' work is just the most solid basis that we have for further elaboration. That doesn't have to mean, of course, that we accept every word that Mises ever wrote at face value, but it means that in very important respects, both as far as substantive issues are concerned, but also questions as epistemology and methodology and so on, he is far superior to, or his work is far superior to the work of any of his main competitors. Which leads me to a related observation, Austrian school. Well, in a way, one could say that Mises just, of course, continued to build up economic science as it was handed down from, well, a couple of previous economists, starting in the 18th century. So in a way, I would say the Austrian school today is, well, the only school of economists that has survived, whereas all others have fallen away from economic science. They've started doing something else. They've started doing applied mathematics. They've started playing econometric games and so on, which has not much to do with economics. Right? Today, one, we are in a phase of a great crisis of economic teaching, both on the European continent, but also in the US, for example, where many students are fleeing the discipline. They're stopping being interested in economics and so on. They're turning toward other disciplines. And one important reason is that economic science seems to be devoid of meaning. Right? It doesn't seem to be related to real economic life, to real human life, and seems to be by and large just an exercise in mathematical formalizing, in modeling, as it is called, and in testing that never leads to any valid and serious insights. So people are turning away from this. And economics, certainly as it is practiced in most departments today, unfortunately, especially as far as research is concerned, is in fact very different than from economics as it has emerged in the 18th and 19th century, and as it is still practiced today in a more refined form by Austrian economists. So the reason why we call ourselves Austrian economists rather than only economists is just a question of product differentiation. Okay, if I say I'm an economist, well, nobody would say, okay, that's just an economist just as the other guys. So there's no reason for me to attend his lectures or his classes and so on. But if I say I'm an Austrian economist, people know, oh, so that's a different branch, right? It's a different product. It's not just ice cream, it's whatever, Eddie and Mike's ice cream or so. It's not just a car, it's a Mercedes. Right? So what you get here is then the Mercedes in economics, whereas elsewhere you get the Fiat Pandas. So Mises and the Austrian school. The Austrian school starts with the work of Karl Menger, about whom I will say more. But Mises is in fact the central figure in the history of the Austrian school because he transformed what Austrian economics is in many important respects, about which I will say later on. So this at the beginning, Mises in fact is not just in a straight line, continuous line. There are breaks there. And Mises brings about important breaks, even as far as his relation with Menger is concerned. And there are continuities which allow us to speak of both of these men as belonging to the same school, and which, in fact, set them apart from all other schools that exist today. So in the Austrian school, then, we need to distinguish between, or it is useful to distinguish between a main line of Austrian economists and various sidelines. The main line of Austrian economists starts with Karl Menger. Lived during this period, 1840 to 1921, and extends through Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk, and then extends through Mises. So here we have our central figure, Ludwig von Mises, 1873, and then to Murray Rothbard and his present-day followers. So if you're 1926 to 1995. And then after Rothbard, which I have to say the main line is continued today, mainly by scholars affiliated with the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Alabama in the United States. So in particular by Professor Hoppe, Professor Salerno, Professor Herbner, myself, and others. And then we have, so this is the main line of Austrian economics, and I will explain in more detail what the common characteristics of this main line is. Essentially, it's a dedication to realist economic theory. I'll say more about what this is later on. And then we have a sideline, the most important sideline of Austrian economists, that starts with Friedrich von Wieser. Who was not inspired, whereas Böhm-Bawerk derived his main inspiration from Menger and continued the Mengerian project, Wieser was at least equally much inspired by an English economist by the name of Jevons, okay, which made Wieser more likely to adopt positivistic habits of economic reasoning that are characteristic today of what the mainstream economists are doing. And in fact, all of Wieser's main contributions have been absorbed by mainstream economists today. So Wieser's most important pupil was Hayek. Friedrich August von Hayek. And the most important disciple, intellectual heir to Hayek was Israel Kirzner, 1930 to our present day. Kirzner was also a student of Mises, so Kirzner is not a Hayekian purebred, but he in fact developed the most important themes in Hayek's economics, not so much business cycle theory, but especially Hayek's theory of economic prices, transmitting knowledge, and so on. And then in the present day, well, this branch is in a crisis. There's no clear-cut heir who is still continuing this project. There are various contenders to the throne. We don't have to deal with them today. We are mainly interested in this branch here. So what I will do in my talk now is to give you a brief introduction to Menger's work and then talk somewhat about Böhm-Bawerk and then go into more detail as far as Mises is concerned. So the main line then starts with a book that Karl Menger wrote in 1871, that he published in 1871, with the title Grundsätze der Volkswirtschaftslehre, Principles of Economics. Okay. And in this book, Menger proposed a new economic theory of value and prices. That is, more precisely, made one great contribution, that is to explain market prices based on the principle of marginal value, about which I will say more in my second lecture today. So whereas a previous economist had explained prices as a function of, or as resulting from, costs of production, Menger explained prices in terms of the needs of consumers and their readiness to pay prices for these consumer goods on the market. And the prices for the consumer goods being paid on the market are then imputed backwards on the prices of producers' goods, and so on. So we have a unified theory of value that explains all market prices by one pervading common principle, which is the principle of marginal value. Okay. Now, what makes Menger's theory so interesting is can be explained in comparison to the theory that was developed about at the same time by William Stanley Jevons, an English economist, and Léon Valras, a French economist living in Switzerland, in Lausanne, who developed very similar theories. So all three thinkers developed a price theory, or proposed a price theory, at about the same time, the early 1870s, in which they explained market prices on the principle of marginal value. Right? And if you go to economics, or if you're an economics student, who is an economics student here? Okay, so not all, but there's a number. Right? So in economics classes today, we still explain prices based on these principles. Right? When we learn the theory of prices, we start with some observations about marginal value, or marginal utility, as it is usually called, and then explain prices as a function, as a resultant, as a consequence of marginal utility. Okay, so far there's agreement. What makes Menger's theory interesting is that he gave a realistic account of this whole phenomenon, right? Whereas Jevons and Valras developed a theory of marginal utility that was mainly fictitious, right? Was a fictitious speculation that could not be directly verified or falsified, right, by information that was at hand. Menger developed a realistic account of marginal value. So he didn't use the word marginal utility. By the way, he didn't even use the word marginal value. Right? He said he used a more complicated way of circumscribing the phenomenon. What was important in any case was the value of individual units of a good about which a choice was being made. Okay. So in Menger's theory, then, all values and prices are explained by a descriptive theory. So the theory itself describes elements of reality. It's not a hypothesis or a fictional stipulation that we make at the beginning of our reasoning and then we make various deductions from it, but he starts from describing various elements of real human life. For example, human beings do have needs, right? The needs have different importance, so there's a ranking between the needs. Every individual good satisfies a concrete and discrete individual need. And so as a consequence, the different individual goods have different importances. Okay. It makes no sense to speak about the value of a class of goods, the value of water or the value of chairs in general, if we want to explain really what is going on the market, if we want to understand human decision making, we need to take account of the context, right? In a context, we have always a concrete chair, this object, for example, And the context is defined by the presence, for example, of other chairs of this type. For example, in this room, we have about, I guess, 80 or so chairs of this type, which makes that the relative importance of one chair of this type is not as high or not as big as if this were the only chair of this type in the world. It would be a unicorn, right? A work of art made by the famous Hubert Strecker, and would therefore have a surplus, command a surplus value. Okay, so here we have then Menger's take, the particular Mengerian edge of his theory of marginal value, and Menger himself was very conscious of the fact that this was what set him apart from both Jevons and Varras. So he had read everything that Jevons had written, he had read everything that Varras had written. He was not impressed by the mathematics, right? And he said, okay, what is important if we want to give a truly scientific account of human life is that we be faithful to the observed fact, that we be faithful to the reality that we can verify, right? And this is not what what we do in mathematics in order to apply mathematical tools to human behavior, to the explanation of human behavior. We need to make various auxiliary stipulations, hypotheses, and so on, lest we cannot make this application. Okay, then Menger has made one other contribution that is worth being mentioned. Namely, he gave an account of the origin of money that was very influential both for Mises but also for other thinkers in the 20th century. So Menger stressed that money did not emerge on the market as a social convention, right? So it was not the case, well, first of all, historically, it's a historical fact, right? That there was never, ever in human history a convention that came together and then decided, okay, well, we would need something that is as useful as money because it allows us to calculate the value of all things, right, in terms of a common unit. So it would be nice to have something of this sort. So let's get together and we just make up an object and say, okay, now, whatever, lamps of this sort are our money, or tablecloth of this sort will be our money. And it was purely a conventional decision to pick up the precious metals, gold or silver, or any, or maybe paper money or something, that resulted then from human deliberation and was ultimately arbitrary. Okay, it was in any case a creation of the political will. So what Menger explained was that first of all, we have the historical fact that no such convention ever took place, which brings up the question, so how did money, in fact, originate? And Menger explained that it came about, money arose as a social institution that touched, well, the lives of all members of society through individual action, okay? This money came into being because what he called indirect exchange is more useful than direct exchange. And as long as people can exchange only consumer goods one against another directly, the market is very limited. Is there any way to erase what I've written here?
Turn the ball.
Okay. So we have true scarcity. I need to ponder my words. This is all what's left for me to say here. Okay. So we have, let's say we have a person A, Paul, and person B, Peter, and Paul owns an apple, and Peter owns a pear, right? And Paul and Peter decide to exchange the apple and the pear, so that's fine. What is if Paul would like to have the pear, but Peter doesn't like to the apple? Peter just is allergic against apples, or thinks that apple trees should be a protected species and not be robbed of their fruits and so on. It would be completely different in the case of pears, by the way. Right, so he doesn't desire the apple, so no exchange would take place. There would be no way for Paul to get a pear. Right? But there might be a way for Paul to get a pair if he can find out, well, what is it that Peter would actually like? What would he be ready to exchange his pair against? And he finds out that Peter likes French cheese. So he gets in touch with François. Not François Mitterrand, because he never exchanged anything useful in his life, but some other François, and exchanges his apple against the cheese, and then takes the cheese to exchange it against Peter's pear. Okay. Then in this case, the cheese is what is called a means of exchange, right? And so we have here an indirect exchange, which extends the market, which creates a greater market than would otherwise have existed. And since this is therefore a useful technique to attain one's ends, it is likely that other people will start imitating the same technique, right? And as a consequence, the practice of indirect exchange becomes ever more widespread. And as a consequence of this, people will also tend to select the most useful, physically useful commodities to perform indirect exchanges, which explains in turn why gold and silver and precious metals in general have been selected by the market as media of exchange, and they have become money, right? Money being a generally accepted medium of exchange. Okay, so this was the Mengarian theory, and was interesting because it explained that how general social institutions emerged through individual action and became general through a process of imitation. Okay. Now, very briefly about Böhm-Bawerk, because we need to move on and talk a little bit about Mises at least. Böhm-Bawerk, well, was probably the most famous Austrian economist of his generation. He was 4-time the head of the Austrian Ministry of Finance. And most of all, what is interesting for us was that he was one of Mises' main teachers. He was certainly the teacher that inspired him most. So Mises took part in Böhm-Bawerk's seminar at the University of Vienna from 1905 to 1913. And Böhm-Bawerk had obtained a chair at the University of Vienna. He had, after his last term as the Minister of Finance, he got an offer from various banks and become one of our chief executives and so on, because he had political connections and so on. He could have made a lot of money. He said, no, forget about this. What interests me most is science. So he became a professor again. And he had a great group of students, Mises among them. Now, Böhm-Bawerk's work, you should retain three elements. Most of all, he has developed a theory of capital and interest, an original theory of capital and interest. Most importantly here, he has explained the interest rates on the market as a consequence of what he called, time preference. Actually, he didn't use this expression. It was invented later by an American economist by the name of Frank Fetter. Okay, but this was Böhm-Bawerk's explanation. Present goods have a higher value than future goods. Right? This was a value phenomenon that Böhm-Bawerk posited. And in light of this value phenomenon, we could explain interest rates emerging on the market. Then Böhm-Bawerk also became a celebrity through his critique of Marxist economics. Right? Karl Marx, during his lifetime, had just published one volume of Das Kapital. And the other two volumes were published after his death by his friend Friedrich Engels. So after the publication of the third volume, when the Marxian system was complete, Böhm-Bawerk published a critique that was very influential, very smashing at the time, and is still a good reading today. Right? So it's still, if you want to have a first critical grasp of the problems of Marxist economics, Böhm-Bawerk's essay is still the way to start. What Böhm-Bawerk observed in particular was that there's a contradiction between observed reality and the postulates of Marx's theory. Right? According to Marx, the interest rate is an exploitation premium, so to say, right? It's squeezed out of the workers. Now, if this is true, then of course the profit or the interest rate that any capitalist can make depends essentially on the proportion of workers as compared to capital, right? The higher the number of workers, the more profit it should make, and the lower the number of workers, the less profit or the less interest he should be able to make. Now, in reality, we observe, in fact, that the interest rate or the profit rates tends to equalize in all industries, irrespective of the numbers of employees. So how does this square with Marxist theory? Right? So we have here a big contradiction that has been squared by Marx through a fictitious postulate, namely by the postulate that his theory only holds true for the aggregate. Okay, so what Marx then in the third volume explained, well, actually, okay, well, it doesn't hold true for every individual firm, but for all firms taken together, it holds true. Okay, but then, of course, he has abandoned the project of a scientific description or scientific analysis of the operation of a capitalist economy. He has not given it, right? Because how can you verify or falsify this assumption that it holds true for the aggregate, but not for every individual firm, right? You still have left a whole field unexplained, namely explaining the behavior of the individual firm, which was the initial plan of Marx to do. And then Böhm-Bawerk also developed a very influential critique of interventionist policies in an essay with the title Macht oder ökonomisches Gesetz, Power or Economic Law? So the question was whether economic phenomena such as wage rates were explained by economic law or were just a function of brute political power wielded either by governments or by powerful labor unions. So the question, and that's still the great question that we have today, we have not advanced one iota beyond this, is, well, can labor unions actually be helpful in increasing wage rates? Right? And Böhm-Bawerk showed that that was not the case. Of course, so the essay, well, I cannot talk more about this because I need to move on to get to Mises finally, right? But I can only recommend that you read this because it has direct applications to the social conflicts that we still have in our time and to various untenable doctrines that are still being spread. Right? Labor unions have the power to increase wage rates. Politicians have the power to improve living conditions of the masses by administrative fiat. In France, we have right now a minister of economics who is ordering, by and large, the oil companies to cut down prices, right? Because he knows, of course, by his wisdom, what the right price for oil should be or for gasoline should be at the gas station. Okay, then Mises. So Mises was Böhm-Bawerk's most important disciple. He was not necessarily the student that Böhm-Bawerk thought was the most brilliant one. Now, that's a very encouraging thing for every one of us, right? At least, I mean, some of us suffer from megalomania, right? But all others who do not, who don't think that they are particularly great and wonderful and so on, rather have a more sober view of their own capacities and so on, well, you don't always need to be a genius to do wonderful and great work, right? And in the case of Mises, well, he happened to be a genius, but he was maybe not quite as much as a genius as another member of Böhm-Bawerk's seminar, who was Schumpeter, right? So Schumpeter was especially a wonderful writer. It's a pleasure to read Schumpeter still today. And he had a very vivid mind, much esprit, as the French say. And he cooked up constantly lots of ideas. The problem was that he never took the time to sort out how the ideas fitted together and how they fit together with reality. Okay, so that was Böhm-Bawerk's critique of the man whom he considered to be his most brilliant disciple, Schumpeter, that he never actually took the time to think through systematically his theories and check them against reality and against themselves. And that was something that Mises did throughout all of his life. And the result was that he was the most important economist of the 20th century, and not Schumpeter. So it's a very encouraging sign. So Mises was born in what was at the time the northeasternmost province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Reich, namely in Galicia, not to be confused with the Galicia that still exists today, northwesternmost province of Spain, it's also Galicia. So here we had Galicia in Austria, and the capital was Lemberg. Today, I believe it's Lviv. Lvov. Lviv is Polish, right?
Yes.
Always confused, always mix this up, yeah. So Lemberg was at the time inhabited predominantly by Polish bourgeoisie and by Jews. Mises' family was Jewish. And his family was one of those who were pushing the Germanization of the eastern provinces, especially the provinces inhabited by Poles. Because for them, German culture was the embodiment of individual liberty. Now imagine this. Right? That was in the middle of the 19th century. 70 years later, Mises had to revise the judgment of his grandfather and great-grandfather. Right? Times had changed. But at the time, so German culture was the embodiment of individual liberty and social progress and so on. So the Mises family was very active in spreading this. And of course, so that was the reason why he, although living in a predominantly Polish environment, well, he was raised in German culture and was a German writer. So most of his, all of his works until 1914 were published, 14 were published in German, and only after his emigration to the United States, he started writing in English. I've anticipated already several things. So Mises was born there. His family moved early on to Vienna, where he was educated. He went to the university. And after the university, he joined the Chamber of Commerce and became the most important economist within the chamber, the chief economist within the chamber, and had a large influence on Austrian politics in the interwar period. In 1934, there was a political crisis in Austria, and the country turned increasingly totalitarian, right, almost government control and so on. And at that point, Mises then accepted an invitation to go to Geneva to a graduate school of international relations that was, in fact, the house graduate school of the United Nations. The League of Nations at the time. Right? So the League of Nations. And they needed to have a school to train all the future international administrators. Mises joined this school on the chair for international economic relations. In 1940, the German troops were overrunning France. Mises emigrated to the United States, arrived in New York, and would stay there for the rest of his life. That is, okay, he left the city from time to time for vacation and trips and so on, but that was his new home. And he died in 1973 in New York City. Now, as far as his life is concerned, his work, his intellectual development is concerned, we have to return again to his days at the University of Vienna. And Mises here started as a student of a man by the name of Karl Grünberg. Can you read this green stuff here? Okay. Karl Grünberg. Who has ever heard of this name? I'm not surprised. So Grünberg was a representative of what was called the German Historical School, right? This Historical School of Economics. There's a group of economists who believed that economists consisted in measuring, in conducting empirical field studies and somehow deriving theory from it, right? So economics was essentially a side branch. Economics was essentially a side branch of historical studies. And we have to study various facts, gather as many facts and information as possible, and then somehow squeeze a theory out of this. Okay, so that was Grünberg's project. And Mises became a disciple of Grünberg, and he was convinced that that was the right approach. And it was only the lacking success of his studies, both the studies of Grünberg himself, but of his own endeavors, that slowly convinced him that there was something fishy about the whole thing. Okay, and then something happened in 1903. In late 1903, Mises read Karl Menger's book on the principles of economics, and became a Mengerian, right, to make a long story short. And the reason why he became a Mengerian was because he now saw for the first time that there could be something like an economic theory that was not just something made up, not just a set of stipulations or fictitious hypotheses, but a discipline that actually described reality, right? And a discipline that answered questions that could not be answered through fact-gathering. Again, right, to make to put it in the most in the shortest possible form, what Mises would later on say was that you need historical inquiries to give a precise account of the state of affairs, right, of the historical state of affairs, to give a precise account of the context in which we find ourselves. But then to understand human action itself, you need economics. Because human reaction within a given context in no way is determined, is not perfectly determined by the environment itself. There is an element that comes from human, from the human beings themselves, and that is free from this environment. We use the word choice, right, to describe this reality. There is something like choice, genuine choice. There's something as a true human liberty, which cannot be exhaustively explained, or which makes that human human behavior cannot be exhaustively explained by giving a complete account of the context in which human action takes place. Okay, and so in order to analyze human behavior completely, we need to have economics. And that was something that Mises realized, or started realizing, at the end of 1903. And so he slowly became an Austrian economist and published the first great fruit of his new outlook, or his new approach in science, in a book that he published in 1912 with the title Theorie des Geldes und der Umlaufsmittel, Theory of Money and Credit. And so this is the starting point of his intellectual endeavors, and he there are a couple of let me just mention a few of his other major works. So in 10 years later, he published another book with the title Die Gemeinwirtschaft, Socialism, right, one of his major works. And then in 1940, a treatise of economics with the title Nationalökonomie, or Economics. And he published an American version 9 years later under the title Human Action. So Human Action is still today the most important, one of the most important works within the Austrian school. And then another book, or two other books that deserve to be mentioned, were 1956, a book with the title Theory and History, and in 1962, a book with the title The Ultimate Foundations of Economic Science. Both of these latter two books deal with questions of methodology and epistemology, which became a great project of Mises, starting from about 1930 or so, and I will say something about this later. About his life, we should also observe that Mises was in private employment more or less throughout his entire life. He was never a full professor at a university, and he taught at the University of Vienna, but he was an unpaid adjunct professor. Okay, why did he do this? Why would he lecture without without being paid? Well, because he enjoyed it, and because he wanted to spread Austrian economics among the rising generation. So he had his main employment with the Chamber of Commerce, and then in his Geneva years, 1934 to 1940, so he was at this school, which was also privately funded, essentially, namely by the Rockefeller Foundation. And then in New York, he was, again, an adjunct professor at New York University from 1945 to 1969, And there too, essentially, his salary was being paid out of private funds. The university didn't find it important enough to spend a cent on Mises. In 1940, I said he emigrated to the United States and then, well, eventually had this professorship at the New York University. And here he had, in a seminar, he built up what is today the Austrian School. So I talked before about main lines and side lines. Today the main line is the most vigorous branch in Austrian economics, and it has come to be the most vigorous branch due to the work of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which was founded about 25 years ago, the mission of which was to spread Mises' work, Mises and Rothbard's work. And the reason why the institute was founded was because at the time, the sideline was becoming more important than the main line, right? So the Hayekian sideline was getting a boost due to the Nobel Prize being accorded to Friedrich von Hayek in 1974. Right? We obtained the Nobel Prize for economics. And as a consequence, well, people became interested in Hayek's works and were drawn increasingly toward problems of the knowledge economy and the spontaneous emergence of institutions, all these Hayekian themes. But as a consequence, the economics came to play a side role, right? Especially the economics developed by Mises and by Rothbard were increasingly left aside. And so there was a market niche, so to say, into which the Mises Institute jumped and helped bring about the present situation. Due to Mises' move to the United States, the Mises School, or the Austrian School insofar as it survived after 1945, was predominantly a Mises school. Right? Mises and his seminar trained the most important Austrian economists of the 1960s through 90s, and here I mention a few names. Hans Zennholz, and then, of course, Rothbard. And we might also mention George Riesman. And it was especially Zennholz and Rothbard, right, who continued the Austrian school and trained more Austrian economists in the post-war period. And again, due to Hayek's Nobel Prize in 1974, this Misesian Austrian school came to be submerged under the upswing of the side branch, and it was only in the past 10, 15, 20 years that the Austrian school in the U.S. has become again predominantly a Mises school. So that is the situation that we have today. So presently, today, we have a Mises school in the United States. And in Europe, the situation is very different. Most people who claim or would call themselves Austrian economists in Europe are actually Hayekians, okay? Or they are heavily influenced by Hayek, which is not bad. There's nothing wrong with this, right? The problem is that Hayek never managed to write a general treatise on economics. So Hayek's work, as far as economics is concerned, is very narrow. It concerns mainly problems of monetary theory and of business cycle theory, and it stops in the 1930s. Right? It stops in the early 1930s. Hayek's last book that he published on economics was in 1941, a book with the title "A Pure Theory of Capital," very difficult book. I think about 10 people in the world who have read it. So Hayek, there's not much of an economics. The Austrian school today, as far as something that can be taught, and that is really an encompassing system of economic analysis, exists only in two forms. Right? And it's very important to keep this in mind. One form is the book with the title Human Action. Okay? Which was written in 1949 by Mises. And the other book is another treatise on economics with the title Man, Economy, and State. 1962, and the author is Rothbard. Right? So the importance of Mises and Rothbard derives from the fact that they alone have created encompassing systems of economic analysis that can be taught, right, and can be the foundation of a school. Like Hayek never produced anything to this effect. And all that Hayek has left us are various sketches of social interpretation, in particular in his later work, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, in the 1970s. Or then we have a book on the Constitution of Liberty, which is which are very good in their own right, but they are not systems of economic analysis. Okay? So therefore, the great problem that we had in the late 1970s, when so much attention was turned to Hayek, was that the Austrian message got diluted. And people started becoming interested in all these various side issues and so on, and the hard core of economic analysis disappeared from the attention. Right? And so today things have changed, fortunately, again, and it is time that we bring this to Europe too. How much time do I still have? Should I stop short, or do I have 15 more minutes to go? 15? 2 minutes? So should I stop at 10:30? Okay. Yeah. Well, then let me briefly talk about some of the main aspects of Mises' work. And I'll first say something about the theory of money and credit, and then move on to the other books. So in the theory of money and credit, Mises makes a couple of contributions, and I will single out three of them. So the main, it was his habilitation thesis at the time, so it was the Berg on the basis of which he would get the license to teach as a professor at Austrian universities. And the main thesis was, in fact, concerned a new theory of the value of money. The value of money had not been explained by Menger. Right? Menger's theory was only, or Menger himself applied his theory only to real goods, consumer goods, producer goods, but not to money. So this was a field left unexplained, and various critics of the Austrian school at the time, such as the German economist Karl Helfferich, who also became a minister of finance, had argued that the Austrian theory could not, in fact, be applied to the theory of money. Only cost of production theories could explain the value of money. So what Mises did then was to show how this problem could be solved on the basis of Menger's marginal value theory. And he did so based on a reformulation of value theory in itself. That is, before Mises set out to apply Menger's theory or Menger's approach to to money, he reformulated and improved Menger's value theory. Okay. The main problem with Menger's value theory was that it was not centered in the analysis of choice. Right? As Menger has added, the value of goods was an objective quality that was a function of human needs, of discrete human needs, individual human needs. Okay? It had nothing to do with choice. And Menger actually said in the introduction of his principles that as soon as we bring choice into the picture, well, if we admit of the reality of human choice, well, the whole thing gets screwed up, and there is no such thing as economic science. Okay? So what Mises then did was to show that actually the theory of marginal value itself was a theory that was entirely based on the reality of choice. It was a description of the reality of choice. For what we do in every choice is to prefer something to another thing. Right? I do prefer, if I go to a shop and buy a bread for, what would be the price here, for five coronas? 10? Okay. Well, you have inflation in Denmark too, right? Okay. So if I buy a bread for 10 coronas, well, then I make a choice. I prefer the bread to the 10 coronas. And as a consequence, we have a value relation here between the bread and the 10 coronas for one individual, namely me, myself. Okay, so that is the foundation of value theory, the preference that people have for some things over for some choice alternatives or over other choice alternatives. So Mises turned Menger's value theory into a preference theory. And then he applied this to the value of money, and he showed, in fact, that the main problem that was perceived to exist in any attempt to apply marginal value theory to money could be solved. The problem, as people perceived it as the time, was that we were moving in a circle. We cannot, in order to explain the marginal value of money, we have to assume an object that has already a purchasing power, because the purpose of money is to be exchanged against other things, right? We buy other things against it. Now, in order to evaluate any sum of money, therefore, we need to have an idea what its purchasing power might be. Okay? So the value, in order to explain the value of money, we need to have its purchasing power. And we need to know something about the purchasing power. But the point was to explain the purchasing power in terms of value. Okay? So we're moving in a circle. We want to explain the purchasing power in terms of value, right? But in order to say something about value, we need to know already something about the purchasing power. Right? So we seem to move in a circle. And Mises showed that that was not actually true, because we have here a determination that runs not in a circle, but that runs through time. Right? So what happens actually is that we know something about the purchasing power today that explains the value, marginal value of money today, because this purchasing power has come into being in the light of the values of the day before. So it's not these values here that determine the purchasing power, but the values of the day before. Okay? The value of money as it was determined by the day before. So then the question is, of course, we're moving back the question, right? How come that money had this value the day before? Apparently, this could only be decided in the light of its purchasing power. Again, but it's not this purchasing power here, but a purchasing power of a period before. Right, so Mises showed that we're not actually moving in a circle, but we're moving back in time in the determination of money prices. And the only question left is this an infinite regress, which would be a logical problem then, right? If we have an infinite regress in time. And Mises' answer was no, because there is a stopping point. Some point here, right? There's a stopping point at the very moment when we use an object as a medium of exchange that so far had not been used as money. And this object has a value because of its qualities as a consumer goods. At some point, for example, cheese, which had just been a consumer's good here for our friend Paul, or for François, was just a consumer good, and at some point in history had been first used as a medium of exchange. Right? So then, only then, he had this additional value, which it obtained because it also served as a medium of exchange, because it also served as money. Right? So this was the way Mises solved this problem, by explaining that the determination of the value of money is diachronic. It's not within a point of time, which would create a circle in the explanation. I know this is a very brief explanation, but just to give you, right, the outline of the argument. So he did this, and in the book he also proposed a new business cycle theory. So in business cycle theory, we'll talk more about this tomorrow. The point is to explain booms and busts, right? And Mises developed a theory, or showed that, in fact, monetary policy was the cause of the business cycle, because monetary policy, or let's say banking policy, to the extent that it increased the money supply, was able to diminish the interest rate below its equilibrium level. And as a consequence, entrepreneurs, because of the low comparatively low interest rate level, would make investments profitable that were not profitable before, right? If the interest rate decreases, interest rate is an important cost component in investment decisions. So if the interest rate decreases, then more investments will be made than would have been made instead. And these investments well, not all of the investments will now be able to be completed, right? Because all that we have done is to increase the quantity of money, thus decreasing the interest rate, but we have not thereby increased the quantity of real goods and services that are needed to complete these investment projects, right? So the increase of the money supply has deluded the entrepreneurs. It has created a mass error. Entrepreneurs do things now that they should not have done. They cannot complete all these projects into which they throw themselves. So it must come sooner or later to a situation in which this impossibility, this physical impossibility, will become apparent. And that's the crisis. You have a question?
Yes, but shouldn't we expect that capitalists is rational and can expect the government intervention?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that was very brief. Tomorrow I have a lecture on business cycle theory, so I'll explain the same thing in much more detail, okay, and I'll also talk about this point. Okay, so we have Mises' business cycle theory, and I have a few more minutes, so I'll just mention a few other of his contributions. In his book, 1922 on Socialism, Mises gave an analysis of the objective of private property, of the role of private property within a capitalist economy, and showed that the beneficiaries of capital goods are in fact the consumers, right? That although we have private property for producer goods, for machines and great production sites and so on, they are all privately owned, but the true beneficiaries are not these owners, they are the consumers of the consumer goods that can be produced ultimately with the help of these sites. So that's a big difference between capitalism and feudalistic systems of social organization that existed before. So most importantly then, Mises also in the same book developed a theory that he had proposed 2 years before in 1920, in one of the most famous economics articles in the 20th century, an article with the title Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. And here Mises explained that socialist systems, socialist societies, could not allocate resources rationally because they would not have the instrument of economic calculation. Economic calculation as we know it is a profitability calculus, right? It's we determine the profit rates that we expect for each investment alternatives. And these profit rates are calculated in terms of money prices, right? We confront the anticipated monetary returns from our project to the anticipated expenditures on factors of production, right? And then we get a profit rate. Now, the problem in socialism is that by definition, we have just one owner of all means of production. So as a consequence, there can be no exchange of means of production. And as a consequence, there can be no market prices for means of production. Okay? So you cannot calculate any profit rate. Right? So contrary to what was at the time the great allegation of the socialists that, well, capitalism was squandering resources, it was utterly inefficient, and you just need to organize the entire society from according to one plan, right? The effective result would be the exact opposite. It would not be more rational to do it, it would be less rational, because they could no longer calculate. So you would have utter anarchy of socialism, right? It was not anarchy of the market, you had anarchy of socialism in the sense of complete disorder. Only the market economy was orderly, because only there you had economic calculation. Now, the book is actually much richer than this, so there also Mises here also develops monopoly theory. And he pioneers another fashionable topic today, namely gender relations, okay? The economic relations between men and females, and marriage in particular, and so on. So Mises talks about this. I can only encourage you to have a look at this. And then there's one last contribution that we should mention, namely Mises' views on epistemology. So Mises held, in clarification of Menger's view about economics as a descriptive, realistic discipline, that economic laws were actually a priori. That is, they did not depend on the observations that we make. That is, the evidence underlying economic laws is not the evidence of the senses, what we see, what we hear, and what we smell. It's evidence that we know about human action, about the structural features of human action, in particular that human beings choose. Right? The fact that human beings choose, we do not know through observations. We cannot observe a choice. Impossible. Right? We cannot observe means and ends. Impossible. Still, we know that these things do exist. Right? So a priori, according to Mises, then, relates to the fact that when Mises says economic theory is a priori, it means that it holds true independent of the observations that we make, that is, the evidence that we get through the senses. Now, this this opinion of Mises has been has raised much more opposition than his views on socialist calculation and monetary theory and so on. It has led to utter incomprehension on the side of virtually all mainstream economists. There's a very famous remark that Milton Friedman once made about Mises and said, well, look, I mean, this is plainly ridiculous to hold that economic theory is not an empirical discipline but a priori. Right? How can, in this way, how can conflicts ever be settled if two praxeologists cannot agree on a proposition? Well, there's only one way out, shoot it out. Okay? Cannot, I mean, if you don't decide your disagreement on the basis of facts, well, you just have to shoot it out. Well, I can only say one thing. So I lived in Alabama for about 6 years. We have very liberal gun laws. Okay, so I myself was a customer of a very nice gun shop in town, and several gun shops in town. And even you as a tourist, you could go there and buy a gun and could show them up at the Mises Institute conference and then settle any conflicts you might have with other praxeologists according to the Friedmanian precept. Okay. Now, the empirical fact is that this never happened once. Okay, that's an empirical fact. So we should say that at least Friedman's theory is not corroborated by the facts. And then, of course, the second observation that we have to make is that, of course, conflicts among positivists economists, positivists of Friedman's sort, who claim that they settle everything according to the empirical record, have never been settled either. Both monetarists and Keynesians have been struggling for decades, right? I mean, three or four decades, and they're constantly debating on the true meaning and the right interpretation of the empirical record. Right? So, I mean, whatever the deficiencies of Mises' view are, in bringing about agreements about economists, well, the positivist camp is at least as deficient. Right? They have not brought about agreements either. Now, this point, I will close with this. So this point is really what sets the Austrian school, in particular the Misesians, today apart from everybody else. Right? It's still this question of method or epistemology. Right? Menger starts off, in distinct contrast to Jevons and Warras, on the other hand, with the project of a realist economic theory, a theory that is really descriptive of reality. And this is the project that has been continued throughout the generations of Austrian economists, has been developed in particular by Mises, but it's developed today by Professor Hoppe and others. Right? And so we'll learn more about this in the last lecture today, before the wedding, on praxeology. Thank you for your attention.